Okay, thank you, DJ. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions, which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Peter has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Hey, Peter Alcoholic.
The
12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of each month, directly after the meeting in person and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Alana. Woo-hoo!
Hi, Alana, alcoholic. Sorry, I never spoke with a microphone. Alana, alcoholic. Grateful to be here tonight. My sobriety date is April 21st, 2022. I have a home group up on the North Shore in Danvers that meets tonight, Wednesday nights, 7:30. I have a sponsor who I am in contact with almost daily, and I sponsor other women in recovery. And I also try to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life daily, which to the best of my ability, which definitely wasn't always the case. This isn't my first time finding sobriety through the steps, hopefully my last time, but I've had some experience with thinking I was, putting my all into it, but what I've come to realize this time around was I definitely, never really had, a third step experience. I was, never really turned my life and my will over to God. I knew I had no problem, with step one, right? I knew my life was a complete and total disaster, in many ways. But I, the third step is kind of, I wasn't even willing to really take a full on third step, and then didn't understand why I kept relapsing in the steps. So just a little backstory. I hate not having a timer to stare at. I grew up here in Massachusetts, up on the North Shore, and from a very young age, I never felt comfortable in my own skin. From as long as I can remember. And I also never felt I fit in. I had two brothers and a sister, and my two brothers were very close in age to me, one older, one younger, and then my sister was a lot younger, right? So, like, I had these two people close to me that were boys that I felt like got, like, you know, more attention than I did. And then my sister, who was much younger and was the baby, you know, it was just always that, like, self-centered, like, me, like, why is it not about me, you know? And, like, always feeling like, you know, a victim and sorry for myself about it. So, yeah, like, that's kind of, like, how I walked through life, like, feeling like life was unfair. And, you know, just, like, all, like, before I even, like, you know, picked up or whatever, like white-knuckling life, like, that's, you know, looking back, like, that's definitely how I did it. Like, I mean, I can remember, like, from a young, like 8 years old, like, feeling like that. So, like, the first time I ever picked up, I got this, like, huge sense of relief. Like, I could, like, breathe and, like, be comfortable and okay in my own skin for the first time in my life. And that's what drugs and alcohol did for me for a long time, you know, till it didn't. And looking back, I definitely had a very abnormal reaction the first time I picked up, right? Like, other friends, you know, we're like, you know, stealing booze from our parents' cabinets or whatever, and like they would have a little and like have fun, but I was the person like blackout and puking and just doing ridiculous things from a very young age. And like even like as far back as middle school, like my friends would be like, what's wrong with you, like why can't you stop? And like I didn't know, like I didn't, and I until I got here, and then I still didn't know because I didn't want to hear it. And so, yeah, like, that's, you know, how my drinking and stuff went. You know, drugs are a part of my story. And the only reason I mention that is because blaming my problems on, like, a highly addictive drug kept me out of these halls for a long time, right? Like, even though I was, like, presented with, like, the disease model, I never really, like, fully understood, like, the allergy and the obsession and all that. You know, I thought I was like a victim of, you know, opiates. And so that kept me out there for a long time. Like, I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, and it took me a long time to realize I did. Like, it took me till I was like drinking against my own will, like putting a bottle to my mouth at 6 a.m., crying while I'm getting ready for it because I didn't want to drink, but like I couldn't not. And like that's when I finally realized I kind of had a problem. And, you know, I wish that was my last drunk, but it wasn't. And, you know, one of the last times I got sober, I thought I was trying to do this work, right? I went away to treatment. I moved to Portland. The STEP community up there, like in houses, you know, I had sponsors, a sponsor. And, but there, the willingness wasn't there. Like, I had the desperation, but that only got me so far because, like, I did not have the willingness. Like, I had certain things that, like, there was absolutely no way I was going to do. Certain amends. And getting honest about certain things. Like, one of my things that I had, you know, ever before I ever even picked up is, like, I loved lying. Like, I would lie about anything from, like, a very young age, like, for attention and just for, like, no reason at all. Like, you know, what's your favorite color? And I'd say turquoise, even though it was pink, you know, like, just dumb, like, whatever I got a high off of it. And so, you know, I've written multiple fourth steps, and this last one, I was always, like, honest in my fourth steps, right? Like, I would write everything down, but my fifth step is, like, where my lying came. Because I would get to certain things and be like, I'm not ready to say that. And, like, you know, if I stay sober, then I'll say it, you know. And surprise, surprise, like, I never stayed sober long enough to say that stuff until, you know, this time around, you know, I finally realized, like, everything I write down, like, I have to be honest and say it, like, I can't hold it back, because writing it, like, for me, my experience writing it isn't enough, like, I need to say that out loud, I need to get it, you know, out in the open between me, God, and, you know, who's ever listening to me, and yeah, so, for me, like I said, like, what was different this time is, like, I have willingness, like, there's people who I haven't made amends to yet, but, like, I have the willingness to do so and have written them out. And it's people who, like, I said, like, absolutely no way, this person does not deserve an amends. You know, they're just as sick as me, if not sicker. But one thing I heard in the halls this time, you know, now that I'm, like, willing to listen, is that, you know, even if the other person is, like, 99% in the wrong, like, I have to own 100% of my 1%. And, like, that's, you know, that, like, really spoke to me, and that kind of was, like, a game changer for me. Sorry, I'm kind of jumping around. You know, the more of the willingness is there, this time, you know, this last relapse I had, you know, it wasn't necessarily the worst, like, as in, like, the things that happened, but, like, that spiritual loss of values, like, was probably the worst it had ever been. I had my 3-year-old nephew, like, under my care, you know, during my previous 18 months of sobriety. I'd taken guardianship of him while my brother and his girlfriend, you know, were getting treatment themselves. And, you know, I relapsed and I lied to everyone, to my husband. You know, my brother ended up getting out of sober living, moving in with us, like, lying to him and just, like, making a mess of my life, right? Trying to, like, just, you know, keep things looking okay on the outside until, like, things got to a point, like, my nephew was situated, and then I could go on and, like, use the drink the way I wanted to and kind of, like, have that be it. I didn't really feel like I had a reason to live or a purpose anymore. And then in the midst of all that, you know, I found out I was pregnant, and that's kind of what catapulted me into recovery this time. And I definitely went at it, like, in a different way. Like, for the first time, even though my life has always depended on my recovery, I actually kind of really felt like my life and my unborn child's life depended on it. So, like, I reached out, found a sponsor, you know, someone who I'd known had really, you know, helped a lot of women in recovery. I did anything she freaking asked me. Like, she asked me to do a gratitude list daily, and, like, I literally, like, the second I woke up, I was writing that gratitude list, like, anything she asked of me, because I was so scared of going back out. And, like, I said, you know, a few different times, like, the willingness I have this time, you know, I'm not doing this perfectly, you know, I said I try to practice these principles in all my affairs on a daily basis, and I do try, you know, sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, but I, every day, wake up with the willingness, to try and do the best that I can to, you know, put together another 24 hours sober. And, you know, hopefully by doing that, you know, my daughter will never have to see me drink. And I think that's my time. Thanks.
Thank you, Alana. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Peter.
Hey, everybody. My name's Peter. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to be here. Nice to see everyone. DJ, it was great to hear you tonight, Elena, Alana, as well. If you don't mind, I'm going to text during the meeting. Is that okay? So my sobriety date's October 25th, 1992. I have found many reasons to have picked up a drink during those years. I've had death, I've had sickness, I've had loss, I've had marriage, I've had divorce, and none of them was reason enough to pick up a drink ever again. Not one of them. Not watching my mother die, not watching my father die, not getting fired from a job that I had for over 20 years. And that's a statement in itself, you know. I grew up in New York, New York City. And when I was about 16 or 17, I started to have a lot of fun. Studio 54, Max's Kansas City, Danceteria, The Tunnel, The World. You know, I was a club kid. I was going to all the clubs. I was having a lot of fun. I was partying. And I had started partying long before that when I was in seventh grade. I was the kid smoking joints in the back of the bus on the way to school. You know, and one of the first things I learned when I got sober is that I'm dyslexic. and I have ADHD. Shocking. But what's different is that it was completely undiagnosed my entire life. I had no idea. So I walked around thinking that I was stupid, that I didn't fit in, that I didn't belong. I didn't know. And so I found my way to fit in by becoming that young boy that was partying really young, really young. And so I did that. You know, I did that for a while. And, you know, about fast forward about 22 years or so, I wake up in my brown box on the streets of New York. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get right for the day. You know, it's October. I had cut a little window in my brown box. I was, I had a girlfriend. I had a girlfriend. She was deaf. And she had a dog. And we all lived in this brown box together. True story, swear to God. And I looked around, and I had tried to get sober 7 times since 1988. We're now 1992. I'd been to detox, rehab, treatment, all of them. And I look around and I think, uh-oh, this is it. It's never going to get any better. I'm doomed. I'm doomed. I'm doomed to this life because I'm not going to die. I'm doomed to this life because nobody can fix me. My parents tried. My friends tried. Everyone tried. I don't want that. I couldn't tolerate who I was. I couldn't tolerate how I felt about myself. I couldn't tolerate the world about me. And I needed to not feel the way I felt. And the only thing that ever worked for me was booze and drugs, right? The doctor's opinion tells me that I have a phenomenon of craving that I don't know I have, right? It tells me that I have a mind that feeds me BS, right? You know, men and women drink essentially because we like the effect of alcohol, right? Love it. Because it changes how I feel. And when I stop, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. Discontent. Nothing is good enough. Not my girlfriend, not my job, not my parents, not my family. Nothing is good enough. I didn't know that. And then on top of it all, I have to have this thing that Silkworth describes as a psychic change. What are you talking about? I have no idea what that is. So I start showing up at AA. I get sober, October 25th, 92, go to detox, go to rehab, go to a halfway house, somehow I end up in Massachusetts, who knows how. Here I am. They tell me go to a meeting every day. They tell me get a sponsor. I got 7 sponsors in a year. One after the other, after the other, after the other. You know why? That guy, he was a handsome guy. He was younger than me. And all the pretty girls went right up to him after the meeting. So I thought, maybe I'll meet a pretty girl. Because a girlfriend was always going to be the thing that fixed me, right? And, you know, then there was the big tough guy. And, you know, there were all these different versions of people who I was attracted to for all the wrong reasons. I was visually attracted to them. They didn't have a message that had depth and weight. They had one of frothy emotional appeal. It's like the air. It's like the white, airy bubbles on top of a beer. There's no substance to it. I needed substance. So I'm going to AA. I'm going to AA. I'm going every day. I'm going on commitments. GSR, DCM. I'm doing it all, right? 24 months into my sobriety, I'm sitting in my rooming house out here on Beacon Street, just before Corey wrote. And I'm looking at my closet that's got no door. I'm looking at my 2 pair of khakis because I got this great job answering phones at Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts, getting yelled at every day for people whose claims weren't getting paid. Right? I'm looking at my black and white TV that I found on trash night, Tuesday nights, right? Brookline, Tuesday night is trash night, I think, right? And it's got an antenna stuffed in it. and I'm watching this little black and white TV, and I'm looking around my room, and I'm sober. And I've done everything that I heard. Not necessarily everything I was told, but everything that I was willing to hear. And it sucked. My sober life sucked. May I use this book? This is what I was experiencing. Huh. It's interesting. I'm going to use this book. I know this book better. So what I was experiencing is what we refer to. We were having trouble with personal relationships sober. We couldn't control our emotional natures sober. We were a prey to misery and depression sober. We couldn't make a living sober. We had a feeling of uselessness sober. We were full of fear sober. We were unhappy sober. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people sober. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than whether we could see lunar newsreels? I was suffering from the bedevilment sober, right? Step one, right? Powerless over alcohol. I got that. Unmanageability, I didn't understand. I didn't understand that I could be sober and be and have a life that was unmanageable. I didn't understand that I could feel so awful. So here's what I did. I'm sitting in that room and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, this is terrible. This is all this is ever going to be. This felt like the day I was living in the brown box, like it was over. The game was up. And I thought to myself, I should kill myself. Nah. I know. I'll move. I'm going to move to Milwaukee. I went through all these things that I should do. And I knew none of them was going to work. I knew it. I knew it from deep down inside. And I went down the three flights of stairs in the rooming house. I took out a quarter. I plopped it into the phone. I opened up my wallet. And I pulled out this little piece of paper that had this guy, Tony was his name, and his phone number. I had never called him before, but I had heard him speak 6 months earlier. And he had a message of weight and depth. He talked about things that I had never heard. So I didn't know this about Tony, but he didn't have an answering machine. He was never home. And he was at an AA meeting 7 nights a week. And he was sponsoring tons of people. I didn't know this, but I thought, I'm going to call this guy. So I pick up the phone and I call him. And it rings, and it rings, and it rings. And he picks it up. And I say, I don't think you remember me. I met you 6 months ago at a meeting. Blah, 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 blah. I'm going to drink. And he said, why would you do that? How can I help you? Let's meet on Wednesday at the Dunkin' Donuts at Cleveland Circle. Where do you live? I live on Beacon Street. Oh, let's meet at the Dunkin' Donuts in Cleveland Circle. And the journey began, and I got a sponsor. And we met that day, and we talked, and we laughed, and we cried in public at a Dunkin' Donuts in Cleveland Circle. And we're laughing, and he stops, and he says to me, you know what your problem is, Peter? And I go, that I'm an alcoholic? And he goes, well, sorta. But your real problem is you don't know the truth. And the truth is what's going to set you free. And I said, what do you mean I don't know the truth? I, of course I know the truth. No, you don't know the truth. You don't know it. You ignore it. You avoid it. How do I learn the truth? He said, we're going to do the steps. I said, how are we going to do that, right? Because I remember going to a meeting. And this guy, you know, he's pretty flamboyant, pretty funny guy. He's up there and he goes, why would you belong to a 12-step program and not do the 12 steps? After that meeting, I walked over and I read these things and I thought to myself, okay, done. I'm good, right? I'm good. I'm all set, right? And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, we'll talk. Here. November 1993. 1994, here. Read the first 63 and a half. Here, read the first 63 and a half pages. Okay. I can't read. I can't sit still long enough to read. My brain doesn't let me read. So 2 weeks go by and I see him and he goes, so did you read it? And I was like, no. And he's like, can you read? And I was like, well, yeah, I can read. He goes, well, then why didn't you read it? And I was like, I don't know. And he goes, let's read it together. Talk about love for a sick and suffering alcoholic. Talk about the willingness to give of oneself. Talk about the selflessness that arises from within when we apply these steps to our life. So he read it to me. Here's what I learned. I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. I am overly sensitive, I am obstinate, and I have unreasonable prejudices that no human power can get me sober, and that God could and would if he were sought. Do you believe in God, Peter?
Yeah.
Do you religious? No. Do you pray? No. Did you ever ask God to get you out of this one? I was like, yeah. He goes, so you pray. And he introduced me to the ideas that are outlined in those first 63 and a half pages, which are really a conversation. There's no action being taken. There's a lot of thoughts, there's a lot of ideas, there's prayers, there's promises, there's warnings. It's telling me I have to have a psychic change, Silkworth. Jung is telling me I have to have a revolutionary shift. If I could do that on my own, I wouldn't be here. There would be no need for that. Stop it. So we get to this point. We read this third step prayer. He says, you want to do the third step? I was like, yeah. We do the third step prayer. He says, and by then, I'm going to meetings with this guy all the time. And we're going to Big Book Step Study meetings. And so we're driving to Marshfield on Thursday nights. We're going to Somerville on Friday nights. I'm going to Linfield on Sunday nights. And I'm hearing what is about to happen to me. So he says, you want to do a third step? I was like, yep. He goes, all right. On our knees, we hold hands. We say the third step prayer. He hands me, here, and he hands me a 5-subject notebook. Here, he hands me a pen. And he says, make a list of everyone you were ever resentful against. I was like, I'm not resentful against anyone. He goes, just make a list of everyone you ever had an ill feeling towards. Gotcha. In about 20 minutes, I had about 700 names. And I was resentful at everyone and anyone that I ever met, that I ever looked at, that ever shared the oxygen I was breathing. And what I really learned, I'm going to just like bring it right here, is that I was resentful at them because they couldn't give me what I needed to feel better about myself, to feel safe, to feel important, to feel valued. Because I didn't have that for me. And I needed you to give it to me. And you couldn't. So desperate, but you couldn't. You probably didn't want to, but I needed you to, so I hated you for it. Right? And I went through this process and I wrote out this fourth step. And, you know, we got to this place where we read the fifth step, you know, and about an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 times a week. We'd just sit and we'd read. He'd sit next to me. I said, why aren't you sitting over there? He goes, I'm going to sit here. There was no skipping any pages. He knew it all. He knew what was coming. I knew what was coming. And here's what I can tell you is at the end of, on page 71, it says, if you have done this, this, and this, you have made but a good beginning. I so desperately wanted that moment when I read my last sex turnaround about myself to be the moment where I was cured, where I was fixed, where I was healed, where I was never going to have to do anything this hard ever again. So desperate. Not the case. It's a 12-step program. It's not a fourth and fifth step process. It's a 12-step process. And for me, 6 and 7, those ideas of being ready to have God remove those defects of character that I saw, dishonesty, self-seeking, selfish, full of fear, and all the different versions of that, right? I was dishonest because I wanted you to fix me. And I knew you couldn't. And I was self-seeking because I gossiped about you. I talked about you because you hurt me. So I would feel better about myself. And I was afraid that I'd never get what I wanted. I would lose what I had. I was afraid of intimacy. I was terrified of vulnerability because I knew you would take advantage of me, that you would hurt me again. Right? I had to be ready to have God remove those. And then in the 7-step prayer, and this is, for me, the beauty of it. So I'm saying the 3rd-step prayer every time I write, every time I read my 5th-step. 3rd-step prayer, 3rd-step prayer, 3rd-step prayer. And now I get to the 7-step prayer, where I ask God to take all of me, good and bad. Why? Good. There's good things about me. The problem is, as I said to my sponsor, why the good? What's up with that? And he said, because your definition of the good and the bad are based on who you once were. They're not based on who you can be. And God will remove from you everything that interferes with your ability to be of maximum service to you, to him, and your fellows. All of it. In his time. Not like that. In his time. God's time is forever. Forever. For me, the 9th step was the most beautiful part. The 8th step list was basically pretty easy. Anyone I had ever harmed, direct, indirect. That 9th step, you know, in the 4th step, when I started writing, I started to experience this belief, this true trust, this faith that this God was going to do something for me that I never even imagined possible. And in my 5th step, I started to know God from the bottom of my heart. I started to really feel the presence. I needed to bring that presence from here to here. And in the 9th step, it was when God kicked the door open, turned on all the lights, and said, "Here I am. Do you want in?" So 10, 11, and 12. This 10th step, this is an amazing thing, right? I'm a true believer that the 10th step is now, the 11th step is tonight. But I think I heard Scott Redmond once say this. So I'm going to read it, but then I'm going to tell you what Scott said. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along and vigorously commence this way of living. As we cleaned up the past, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Holy moly. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly. At once, immediately. Not tonight, not when I can put pen to paper, at once and immediately. And make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. What Scott Redmond said was this: if you do this every day, the only thing that will ever happen to you is change. And I defy you not to change. And that's been the truth. When I do this every day, the only thing that happens to me is I grow in understanding and effectiveness. I become more so. I'm allowed to become who it is I was intended to be. About, you know, when I was writing my fourth step, my sponsor said to me, I want you to start reading 84 to 88 every day. And I was like, sure, whatever. And so I did the best I could with that, but for a long time I did. I read it every day. And then there was a little while where I didn't. Things got pretty funky. Then I started reading it again, maybe every day, then maybe a couple times a week or whatever. And then I got back to reading it about, I don't know, 9 months ago. I was sitting at the kitchen table. My common-law, that would be my girlfriend, who's been my girlfriend long enough to be my common-law wife, so we call each other common-law. And we enjoy that. We enjoy that. We have fun. I'm sitting there, and I'm reading this thing. You know, I'm sitting there with the big book, and she's making her oatmeal, and she's sober 37 years. So I'm reading this. She's making oatmeal, and I look up at her, and I say, it says somewhere in there, you know, we can do this with our wives, right? And I look up at her and I say, do you want to do this with me? And she was like, yeah, sure. She goes, but I don't want to read the whole thing all at once. Can we do morning and night? I was like, it's so against my nature. I'm so OCD. I was like, no, this is how you got to do it, right? And I was like, sure. So every morning we sit down and we read Upon Awakening. We drink some coffee and we read through that. And then every night we lay in bed with our dog in between us and we read when we retire at night. And we ask the questions and we ask, were you resentful? Yes. No. Right? And we answer those questions out loud. And we apply this to our lives. And what happens, that got loud, huh? What happens is this. Life will take on a new meaning. How much time do I have? You forgot. Okay. I like you. Life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you. You have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. Don't miss this thing. This thing is unbelievable. And I grabbed this because when I got here, the old timers, who were probably my age at the time, scary, would say something like this. They'd say, if you want what we have, do what we do. And I'd be like, yeah, they got time, man. I want time. I want to stay sober as long as these guys. But here's what I think they were really saying. Understanding is the key to right principles and attitudes. And right action is the key to good living. Therefore, the joy of good living is the theme of the 12th step. That's what I want. I want to feel the joy of life. I want to have peace of mind. I want to put my head down on the pillow at the end of the day and fall right to sleep. I don't want to I don't want to worry about my boss who's given me a hard time, or my boss's boss who's given me a harder time, or my girlfriend's son who's out there partying his ass off, right? The dude's having a good time. He's 21 years old and he's stoned every day, right? And letting him have it, right? Letting him have what he needs to have to get to where he needs to be, right? And he knows where it's safe, and he knows he can come whenever he's ready. Being part of this thing, being one of many, never speaking from the mountaintop, but always speaking from level ground. Finding the humility that's required in step 7 for me to apply the rest of these steps in my life. Knowing, that my obligation and responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous is this and only this. To be ready and willing to put my hand out when somebody needs it. Period. That is why I am sober today. That is why I am here tonight. That is why I will be at my next meeting tomorrow. So my sponsor's old now. He's 84. Yeah, he's 84. He's been my sponsor for 29 and a half years. One guy. Because I don't want to ever have to tell anyone else what I've told him, right? And, you know, we talk twice a week. He lives in West Roxbury, I live in Chelmsford, but we talk twice a week. How's it going? He's old, he's not well, you know, he's, and, you know, we talk about that. And he was like, so who's going to be your next sponsor? And I'm like, well, that's not the issue. How can we prolong this relationship? And he's like, we'll always have this relationship, whether it's here or somewhere else, you know? This thing that we do is so special. We don't even know it. I think it's on page, you know, when we get here and they start talking about God, and they're like, God, I don't want to know about God. Do I have 2 minutes? Yeah, look at me. It's like I have a clock in my head. Right? It's at the bottom of 56, we agnostics. And he's coming to terms with whatever this idea of God is. And I remember talking to my friend Jack, and I was like, Jack, what is this God thing? Oh my God, you know, like, what is God, right? And he's like, this is what God is, Peter. It says, he stood in the presence of infinite power and love. And that I can live with. That this thing we do introduces us to infinite power and love. And the gift keeps giving. So, if you're not drinking today, congratulations. If you're not drinking today and you want to drink, that's normal. If you're looking for help, you're in the right place. If you're on the other side and you're living in these 12 steps, just remember, we're not better. We're just another guy on the journey. It's our responsibility to continue to give and give and give and give and give. Taking is finished. Giving is all we got. God bless.
All right, thank you, Peter. Now we have Mike.